Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Buddhaṃ dhammaṃ saṅghaṃ namassāmi.
If you could take the lights off again. Thank you. Thank you. Well, we've been together now for 3 days. Might feel like longer, yeah. but if my calculations are correct, Monday to Tuesday, Tuesday to Wednesday, Wednesday to Thursday. So 3 days we've been on this little adventure in each other's company, and during this time, exploring these non-dual teachings of the Buddha, and hopefully putting these into practice, exploring and understanding what they're about, how they work, how to apply them. These teachings are very subtle and profound, and this kind of transcendent wisdom or ultimate reality teachings that can be very inspiring, and so we can relate to these in the way of considering, well, this is the most important stuff, you know, this is what's really interesting, true insight, pure wisdom, this is it. So I don't want to be bothered with mere mundane reality. Conventional truth, pa! Yeah, why bother with conventional realities? This is the real thing. Yeah, the ultimate transcendent Dharma teachings. It's natural enough to think like this, but as I hope I've managed to convey or to speak about the way of the Buddha is a way of practice that doesn't just dwell upon the transcendent teachings, but points out how a transcendental reality or the ultimate reality is necessarily related to the conventional reality. I was reflecting on this today as I was speaking, and I was reminded of when I was first asked to give a presentation on these kind of teachings. This was a long time ago now. Back in about 1997, I think, and in California, this was at the beginning of what was called the Community Dharma Leaders Program, and this was a program developed by James Barras to help, support and educate people who were living all over the USA and Canada. Also other countries too. Stephen Fulder was part of that CDL program to help equip people with more understanding, more experience of Dharma teachings, so that within their local communities they would be more well supported, knowledgeable, and capable of helping to run groups and organize retreats and lead sessions and so on. Sometime in 1997, James came to me and said, "You know, Ajahn, people these days, all the Vipassana people, they're going off to Punjabi in India, and they're going to all these Dzogchen retreats with Tulku Urgyen or Tsoknyi Rinpoche and all these great and good people. And they're interested in Dzogchen and Advaita Vedanta, and you know, I know there are these kind of ultimate reality teachings, these non-dual teachings in the Theravada, but I don't know where to find them." Yeah. I know a couple of teachings, but could you possibly put together a little session for the Community Dharma Leaders program and come and do a presentation one day? So I said, as I usually do, sure. Yeah. And so was when I first started gathering together some of these, the teachings, many of which I've been quoting to you and referring to you during these days together, and also that now collected together in that chunky book called The Island. So The Island was really the end result of that initial inquiry request from James all those years ago. So the reason why I mentioned it was because it was very interesting gathering together all these very profound and transcendent teachings. And then on the morning that I was due to present them at it was the very first Community Dharma Leaders sessions. It was at a place called Santa Sabina in Northern California. And normally I'm a pretty healthy person. You know, I have quite a good, robust system. And I was fine until about 9:30 that morning. I was supposed to start the presentation for the CDL group at about 10. Got to Santa Sabina about 9:20, 9:30. Got out of the car, got myself ready. I was sitting in the little side room in the center, and suddenly I felt, ooh, I don't feel well at all. I started sweating, and my heart was pounding, and I felt this extreme sickness, nausea. And I don't feel well at all. And had to go literally running straight to the bathroom, and was extremely sick. What is technically known in English as projectile vomiting, which tells you all you need to know about that. So that was very, very unusual for me to be so ill. And I was violently sick, you know, with this extreme vomiting. And so there I was, leaning against the bathroom wall, sweating and heart pounding and feeling really sick, and thinking, in 10 minutes' time, I'm supposed to be giving these ultimate reality teachings. Perhaps there's a message here. And it really was, you know, literally right up until 5 to 10, I was throwing up. And then just at about 5 to 10, it sort of, the nausea subsided, and I went, maybe some of you were even there in that group, I can't remember. But I came into the room and said, good morning, good to see you all, and and did a whole 2-hour presentation. So then I was due to have lunch just after 12. About 5 to 12, I started feeling extremely shaky once again. And then with all the composure I could manage, I said goodbye to everyone, left the room, and then ran straight back to the bathroom. And heaves the rest of my the contents of my guts, you know, into the bathroom. So I'm not that I'm superstitious not sure how these things work, but it was a really good message about how the mundane and the absolute are very closely interwoven, that you cannot just absorb your attention into these high-minded transcendent realities, that the force of the mundane is completely unavoidable. It's right here. Whether it was some kind of karmic thing or not, I don't know. But certainly it sticks in my mind. And it was a good message. It was a good message about the inseparability of the these two aspects, vijja and charana, knowledge and conduct. As I've been saying, this also around this time reflecting on the word Tathagata, as how that even though it might seem just like a way of looking at the etymology of a word, the Buddha was very careful in his use of language and very creative. He also liked puns and word plays. There's a lot when you read the translations of the Pali Canon, you don't get a lot of humor. But I remember many years ago, this wonderful elder Sri Lankan monk, Venerable Ananda Maitreya, who could speak about 12 or 13 languages, and he could converse in Pali. He could, like, chat in Pali. And he said, you know, the Pali Canon is really filled with a lot of humor. He says there's a lot of puns and word plays that the Buddha uses that the translators into English have mostly missed completely. But if you speak Indian languages, if you speak, you know, Hindi or Sanskrit or Pali, then you get a lot of these double meanings that the Buddha used all the time. So my theory is that the Buddha very deliberately coined the word. He created the word Tathagata to express this quality of both fully present and attuned to the mundane relative world and both fully transcendent. Also, earlier today I was talking about the role of sila or virtue and the teachings there in the Upposita Sutta, the Buddha's basis for forming the what's called the eight precepts, the customary observance in the southern Buddhist countries for the moon days, the new moon day, the full moon day, and the two half moon days. In this respect, it's useful to consider how that mundane reality is to be considered, or how we live in relationship to that, or also how the quality of wisdom and that transcendent understanding manifests itself in the realm of our conduct. So hopefully during today that was something that you were able to look at and investigate and get a bit of a sense for. I also thought it might be interesting to talk about another teaching of the Buddha's, which it really reflects his extremely practical you could say utilitarian. It's a long word. I know some of you understand it. Yeah. So the very practical, down-to-earth relationship to conduct, and also to, as we were discussing in the question and answer session yesterday, the whole role of karma and vipaka, the action and its results. And this is also a very useful, practical teaching about superstition. Because many of us are drawn to Buddhist teachings because of feeling disappointed with other religious forms or the religions that we've inherited, maybe Judaism or Christianity, Catholicism or Anglican, Protestant Christianity, and the kind of belief systems that we get handed to us, that you're supposed to believe that, you know, God wants us to do this, or that if you do, if you act in this way, you're going to be punished by going to hell, or you'll be afflicted in various different ways because of what you do. And so there's this very interesting teaching. It's Sutta number 60 in the Majjhima Nikaya, middle-length discourses. It's called the Apanaka Sutta, and Apanaka means incontrovertible, another long English word. You're going to all have increased your vocabulary by the end of this retreat. Even those of you for whom English is your first language. So incontrovertible, which means you can't argue against it. You can't go against it. You can't argue with it. Of course, sure you can try. But that's what apanaka means. And so in this discourse, the Buddha lays out his relationship to the idea of karma and past lives, future lives, and such like. And as a way of summarizing it, he begins by saying, you know, if you ask me, according to my perception of things, I say that there are past lives, there are future, there's this present life, there are future lives, and that living beings experience the results of their good and bad actions, you know, either in this present life or in future lives. And we experience here and now the results of actions either carried out in this life or in lives before this one. So if you, and this is the Buddha's expression of this, he says, if you ask me from my perspective on it, that's how I see it as working. But then he very interestingly says, you know, basically he says, well, I might be wrong. Yeah, that's how I say it, that's how I see it, but, you know, I could be wrong. And then he then says, well, it might be the case that that's not what happens. So there, say there is a good person, and this good person chooses to act in a way that is selfish, greedy, cruel, dishonest. During this lifetime, such a person acting in that way, they will tend to attract unskillful friends to them. They will be criticized by wise people. They will probably sleep badly at night. They will probably live with a certain degree of anxiety, fear of being attacked or their dishonesty being found out. And at the end of their life, they're likely to be filled with regret, with remorse. So, it might be the case that there is no life after this one. And even if there is no life after this one, that person, and he's very polite, he says, that good person, well, that worthy person, has made a miserable abiding. They've made a miserable mode of living for themselves here and now. And if it happens to be the case that there is a life after this one, then those actions, those modes of being, will probably take them to a, quote, unpleasant destination. No more details. But then, on the other hand, he says, then consider another worthy person, another good person, and this person, you know, she chooses to live in a virtuous way. She is kind, generous, honest, is, say, straightforward in her speech, is unselfish, and acts in a noble and generous way. So, such a person, they will attract worthy and noble friends to them. They will be praised by the wise. They will tend to be living without anxiety. They will tend to sleep well at night. And at the end of their life, such a person will tend to have few or no regrets. Now, it might be the case that there is no life after this one, and this is the only life that we have. Again, he's very very straightforward and polite in the way he says it. It might well be that there's no life after this one, but even if there is not, this good person has made a pleasant abiding for herself here and now. And if there is a life after this one, then it's likely that that person's actions, their mode of being, will take them to a pleasant destination. So, let the wise choose for themselves. So this is a very wonderful and helpful teaching, I find, and particularly those of you who are being asked questions about, you know, what happens after this life, or are we reborn, or do you believe in past lives and future lives? And you can quote this sutta. I've given a very abbreviated, short version of it here, but you can go and look it up for yourself, sutta number 60 in the middle-length discourses. But it's very, very useful because a lot of the people that one meets, and maybe you yourself, are out of a skeptical materialist background. You don't like the idea of past lives or future lives, sort of allergic to all that kind of mythological stuff. Many eminent Buddhist teachers that you find, writers, teachers that, you know, don't like that at all. Even though it's heavily represented in the canon, the Pali teachings. If you, as an experiment one time, because a number of people I was encountering in the States in particular saying, you know, the Buddha didn't really teach that stuff, did he, Ajahn? I mean, not really. You know, it's just sort of put in there later on by other people who kind of like the superstition. Yes? And I said, well, so I did the, I'm a sort of scientist by training, so I did the stats. I looked at the statistics and went through the whole, at least the middle-length discourses, and I counted up the number of places where there's references to past lives, future lives, other realms of beings, you know, hell realms, heavenly realms, devatas and such. And it's a full 33% of the teachings in the middle-length discourses have references of that kind. So if there was some editing going on, there's a lot. There's a heck of a lot of editing and what they call interpolating, sort of introducing extra bits here and there. So anyway, but even so, even despite the evidence, some people don't like the idea of past lives, future lives, and the what you can call the metaphysical side of the Dharma teachings, like clear, practical, visible, tangible world is what people like to refer to, and that's fine. And so I feel this Panaka Sutta is really a marvelous and helpful expression of you know the Buddha's basis for encouraging wholesome conduct. It's very straightforward. It's just right here and now. You know that if you're wise, you'll live in a way that's respectful, that's harmless, that's gentle, that is honest. Simply because you do yourself more favors that way. It's just like if you want to put the odds in your favor of not having a car crash or not getting a ticket from the traffic police, then you keep to the speed limit, you drive on the correct side of the road, you pay attention and relate respectfully to the rest of the vehicles on the road, and then you're doing the best that you can to get to your destination without trouble. You can't guarantee that it's gonna work, but you're putting the odds in your favor. If you have a few drinks before you set off, you drive on the wrong side of the road, you don't keep to the speed limit, you don't check your brakes, you don't look for the blue lights on the police vehicles, you'll probably end up in an unpleasant destination of one kind or another. It's just practical. It's just physics, you know. It's just the way that things work. I thought I'd mention that simply because also there have been a few devatas appearing in these sutta quotations, you know, and some of you might be having this sort of, I don't like all these angels, you know. I got into Buddhism to get away from all that stuff, you know, pillars of fire and the parting of the Red Sea. Ugh! You know, I came to Buddhism to get away from all that hocus pocus, as sometimes called. But these kind of stories get everywhere. But it's also important to see that the Dharma teachings don't depend on that kind of thing, and it's not a requirement. And that the teachings on karma and its results, karma and vipaka, the Buddha focused far more on this or more helpfully on this practical, visible, tangible results of our actions. Also, in respect to our conduct and looking at this mundane side of things, it's helpful to consider the whole area of decision making, how we make choices, yeah, in terms of our action, what we choose to say, what we choose to do, how we make decisions and work with choices. Earlier today, when I was having a conversation with some of the retreat cooks and helpers. You know, this was one of the questions that came up, and I was also referring back to some of the things I've been saying about how it's we can use the meditation to help us, you know, put aside the conceiving and conceptualizing mind, all of the mind that tends to create the long list of shoulds and shouldn'ts, you know, pluses and minuses, and trying to calculate our way to certainty, trying to get beyond doubt by thinking. And those of us who try to do that, I often feel it's like an ongoing courtroom battle. You know, these two sets of lawyers. You know, you have the prosecution and the defense, and you know, say, "Oh, but Your Honor, on the other hand," and then the prosecution makes a case, and then the defense gets up and says, "Yeah, but that's not the case because of this, 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 this." And the prosecution gets up and says, "Ah, but you haven't considered this, 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 this." And then, even when you finally get the judge to make a decision, then they go to appeal, and it starts all over again. Yeah. Goes to a higher court. Yeah. So, trying to think your way to certainty, and again, I speak from painful experience, doesn't always work, and can just be a long, dragged-out experience of doubting and conceptual proliferation. So, as I was describing the other day, one of the great skills that we can develop, very useful skills, is learning how to consult our own oracle. I realize that sounds a bit sort of California-ish. To consult your own oracle, but I was in California for a long time. And we are in a place of the oracle, so in Endor. So, but that is a process or a method that we can use. And when we learn to drop all of the questioning and the calculating and the conceptualizing, then we find that the answer can appear. And as I was saying, sometimes when we, you know, put all that conceptualizing aside and just and then just ask or to look into our own heart to consider, well, you know, what in my heart of hearts do I really feel is most important here, or what really feels like the best way forward, then sometimes it can just be vividly clear. Well, that's what you really want, idiot. Do that. Or it can, at the other end of the spectrum, be, right now, it's not knowable. It's foggy. You can't see. And it's not a matter of just turning up the lights even brighter, because if you've ever been in a car in the fog, you turn up the lights brighter and you can see even less. So sometimes you just have to wait until the fog lifts. But even that kind of a knowing is helpful. At this moment, you know that it's not knowable. Therefore, just wait, be still, and let things, yeah, move along in their own way. You know, also, so I hope that that's a principle that people can get a feeling for. Maybe you've been working with that a little bit in the last day or so since I was mentioning it. But it's a kind of process that I use a lot, and you can find it being very, very helpful. Sometimes we get so busy with our thoughts, we get so tangled up in them, so caught up, we don't give the respect to our own felt sense, which is maybe right there and very clear and strong, but we don't pay attention to it. And I was giving the example of how when I was in, again, I was teaching a meditation day at Spirit Rock in California, and it was a day long on this theme of using inquiry and working with doubt. And this person came to talk with me in one of the breaks, and she was a Mexican woman, so out of a Catholic background, and she was saying, "Oh, Ajahn, I've got this really big problem. My husband, he's really abusive and awful, but we've been married for 30 years, and my kids are telling me that, you know, we ought to break up and that it's no good for me, but, you know, I feel I should carry on. And there's this whole long, long, long list of shoulds and shouldn'ts and rights and wrongs. And so I started talking to her about this, and I said, well, you know, I was saying how we can, if we pay attention, we can consciously, you know, put aside all the long lists of shoulds and shouldn'ts and just ask ourselves, you know, what's the most important thing to me? What in my heart of hearts do I really feel about this? You know? And as I was saying that, as I was saying that sentence, that what in my heart of hearts do I really feel about this shit? Got it. And I literally hadn't even finished the sentence. And so right there, as we were talking, she just, and you know, it was quite, she never told me what she decided. I've got a suspicion, but it was quite remarkable because she'd been agonizing over the issue for months and months, just filled up with all shoulds and shouldn'ts and all the pros and the cons and so trying so hard to get it right that she hadn't really listened to that inner wisdom, her intuitive wisdom. And when she gave herself permission to listen to that, then it was right there. And it was quite amazing. Her expression on her face changed completely. It's like, got it. And it was so quick and so clear. And so I felt that was a wonderful example of how when we just take the trouble to sort of open the box and look, look what's in here, then we can get a much greater sense of clarity. And it's a kind of certainty that is not conceptual. It's like when you put a shoe on, you might have the thought, oh, that shoe fits. But you know the shoe fits without even saying the words to yourself. You know the shoe fits. Or the shoe doesn't fit. It's a non-conceptual knowing. So that when we say look within and draw upon our own intuitive wisdom, then there's that same kind of non-conceptual knowing. Now, it's also helpful, and this was part of our discussion with the people earlier today, was we have a weird relationship to success and failure. Generally speaking, in the West and in the sort of particularly the sort of middle class intellectual world, but generally speaking, most of the world over, we have a very strange relationship to success and failure. And it's also built up around the cult of the individual. Like, I want to succeed. That's the most important thing. And if I succeed, if I get it right, I win the prize, I get the praise, I'm awarded the job, somebody says they love me, that's good. That's an absolute and complete good. And, at the opposite end, if I fail, I get it wrong, I get fired from the job, someone says they don't love me, then that's the worst. I've failed. That's a disaster. That's an unqualified and a total disaster. It's the awful thing, what I don't want to happen. Is this familiar? I'm not reading minds, I'm just, you know, working on statistics again. This is often how it is for us. So I would suggest this is a very weird way to relate to success and failure. So first of all, there's a little exercise I like to suggest to people, which is take a moment to consider something within 5 years ago, 10 years ago, that when it happened, you thought, great, fantastic, this is marvelous, I'm so happy. You got the job, your thesis got accepted, your beloved said yes, and you got married, or you bought the new house, you started the new company, and then 5 years, 10 years later, you're thinking, how on earth could I have been celebrating? That was a total disaster. I can't believe I was so happy. at that time. What was I thinking of? Anyone had an experience like that? No? So what we were celebrating at the time, 5 years later, 10 years later, we look at that and think, oh, well, I had no idea what I was getting myself into. Yeah, I should have guessed that it's going to be more complicated, more difficult. At the other end of the spectrum, then again, 5 years ago, 10 years ago, think of something that at the time you thought, this is a disaster, this is awful, it's totally wrecked, it's the worst has happened, my marriage has ended, I've got fired from the job, my thesis got rejected, I got the worst book review in the world. Beloved family members died. It's painful, it's a disaster, it's awful. And then 5 years later, 10 years later, we look back and we see, well, I would never have asked for that, but actually that was the best thing that ever happened to me. Any of those? Probably one or two in the room. Yeah. So, what does that tell us about success and failure? About things going well or things going badly? What it says to me is that there's always more layers to it, and it's also much less personal. It's much less confined to my feelings than we usually take it to be. So when we are considering the success and failure, rather what's important, and what I always like to suggest in relationship to this, is to look at that grasping of success. When something goes well, rather than yes, I've got it, to recognize this is a sweet taste, this is a delicious, I won the prize, very nice, but also recognizing, well, I won the prize, but there's like 25 people who didn't win the prize and they're not looking very happy. Okay, well, there's also compassion for those that didn't get the prize. Okay, my sweetness is also their bitterness. Okay. Let's take that in as well. So it's a sweet feeling, but you're not getting drunk on it. You're not investing in it. You're not getting born into it. And then having had that success, okay, this is sweet. Now, what do I learn from this? What does this teach me? So that becomes the principal thing. Not how can I claim this and own this and keep this, but okay, this is sweet. This is delightful. What do I learn from this? And then similarly, we try something else. We launch a project, we publish a book, we start a relationship, we go on a meditation retreat, and then you realize, well, that's a disaster. This just didn't work. This is really awful. This is painful, miserable, difficult. It's a failure. Okay, rather than this is a disaster, what are they going to think about me? You know, how much of our life is based on what they, the mysterious they, what they will think of me? I've never met them, but they're always the people that we're worried about, the judgments that they make. Instead of buying into that, being born into that failing, then just to consider, well, this is bitter. This is a bitter experience. I thought this looked like a good direction. Well, that was a big mistake. Okay, what does this teach me? And those of you who can remember your science classes in high school, and maybe many of you are scientists or even science teachers, at least what I was told when I was about 12 or 13 years old, and by the chemistry teacher, was there's no such thing as a failed experiment. every experiment will teach you. So in exactly the same way, when we experience that bitterness of things going wrong, it's awful. Okay, what does this teach me? So we're using failure and success in exactly the same way. Rather than investing in the sweetness or the bitterness, we instead look at it and say, okay, what does this teach me? How do I learn from this? So this radically changes the way we relate to success and failure. So we make choices based on, okay, this looks like a good direction. Let's see where this goes. Let's see. And then if it turns into a conventional success, okay, this looks like the right direction. You keep going. And then if it continues in a good way, fine. But you're not getting drunk on it, getting lost in it. If it looks good for a while and then you find yourself falling off a cliff, okay, that didn't work. Backtrack, you know, try a different direction. So then we find that we're not embarrassed or ashamed when we make a mistake, but rather, okay, no, that didn't work, let's try again. And also you're not getting proud or inflated when things go well. And so that then there's a far more balanced and integrated way of relating to those. In the States, there's a very beautiful Native American proverb, which is, no matter how far you've gone down the wrong path, when you find out, turn back. that thought, well, I've gone so far, I don't want to waste all the effort that I've made, I'll just keep going. Yeah, don't listen to that one. Okay. We took the wrong turning. Let's turn around and go back. Well, you know, if you can take a side road, then do that. But you know, basically, don't be afraid. Don't be too proud to not correct the mistakes that you've made. Though this, I find it just in terms of integrating wisdom together with the way that the conventional world works, then in this way we're looking at karma and its results, action, and also the role of intention. And again, part of the discussion earlier today was a very interesting conversation about how, well, you can have a good intention, you meant very well, but then it turned out really painful. So there was you had a good intention, but you were badly informed. You were working on a weird basis. You're doing what your parents told you. And so that you thought you were doing the right thing, but you didn't realize what it was going to lead to. And so, again, following up the conversation that we were having yesterday, having good intentions, when our intentions are noble or wholesome, then that's going to have a better karmic result than if our intentions are selfish or greedy or destructive. You know, the example I gave was that if I know that someone, say, what's your name?
Leela.
So if I... Leela. If I know Leela is allergic to peanuts, and I say, oh, I'm going to play a trick on Leela and offer her a cookie that's got nuts in it. And so I think, here, Leela, have a cookie. And then she takes a bite of this cookie, goes into anaphylactic shock, another long English word, goes into shock, has to be rushed off to the hospital. And then if I'm thinking, ha, 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 I tricked her, this is an extremely unskillful intention. I think everyone would agree. Causing harm for the sake of amusement is a very unskillful thing. If I have no clue that Leela is allergic to nuts, and I don't even know that there's nuts in the cookie, and I say, oh, Leela, would you like a cookie? And then she looks at it and thinks, well, that doesn't look as though it's got any nuts in it. Okay, that looks safe. And then she takes a bite. Then I feel bad. Yeah. Oh dear, you know, she's ill because of that cookie I gave her. But the after effect on me is going to be far less harmful and negative, because I wasn't intending harm. It was an accident, and so the karmic result would be far lighter. And so the intention makes a big difference there. Now, even when we intend good, it's something that is meant to be helpful, like giving someone a cookie and they're allergic, then the important thing is then when we realize, well, that was a bad choice, or I should have made sure. So the important thing about intentions then is to apply them with wisdom, to learn from the mistakes that we make, even when we have good intentions, to recognize that with the best of intentions, we can sometimes misjudge things. We make mistakes. We don't get things perfectly on the mark. And in the those of you who are familiar with English expressions, there's a very well-known one that says, the road to hell is paved with good intentions. You can follow that. So the road, you know, like the tarmac on the road, or the stones that pave the road to hell is paved with good intentions. So that with the best of intentions, we often make a really big mess. So in that respect, it's important to apply good intentions with wisdom. And in this respect, a useful teaching that the Buddha gave about success was called the four bases of success, the four Iddhipada. If you want to succeed at everything, at anything, whether it's with your spiritual practice, your meditation, whether it's your business, whether it's your family life, whether it's cooking a meal, or you know, starting a fight, you know, the four elements to that. Now, the first is chanda. We need to be interested. The second is virya. We need to apply energy. The third one is chitta. We need to think about what it is that we want to do. So if we're trying to cook a meal, we need to be interested to cook a meal. We need to apply the effort to cook. Chitta, we need to think about what it is that we want to cook. How do we want to cook it? And then the fourth one, which is the most significant in this respect, is vimamsa, which is not a common Pali word. Vimamsa, V-I-M-A-M with a dot, S-A, vimamsa. And that means reviewing or looking at the result. So, okay, I wanted to cook a meal, I wanted to prepare the food, and I put energy into it, I thought about what I was going to prepare. How did it turn out? Did it work? Did it take the shape that I wanted it to? Did it taste the way I wanted it to? How did it work? Well, the spaghetti was good, yeah, but that the cheesecake was a disaster. Okay, so the vimamsa is looking at the results of what we've done. So that's where the feedback process is fed. So when we look at our intentions, okay, we carry something out with a good intention. Then the vimamsa is, well, did that work? Did it not? What was the effect of that? Was that helpful? Was it not? Did it turn out as I wished or not? So then that's what helps to, inform our choices in the future, is that element of vimamsa. So this is called the four bases of success, the Iddhipada, I-D-D-H-A-P-A-D-A, or P. Long A, the Iddhipada. And that's when I was talking about it earlier today, one woman commented, yeah, Buddha had a good business model. So it maps out, yeah, that's how things work. So that when we are applying wisdom in terms of how to function in the world, how to make choices about skillful action and speech, then, the key element for cultivating wisdom and learning skill is that vimamsa. If we're trying to speak in skillful ways, we're trying to act in skillful ways, is it working? Is it not working? Yeah. How can we improve things? How can we do better? And so that vimamsa element is incredibly important, because that informs us as to how to use the pleasant and painful results of the choices that we've made. And so then our choice of action and speech is continually being informed by wisdom and sensitivity to the time, the place, the situation. And speaking of sensitivity to time and place, I've gone over my allotted time again. So I'll finish there, offer these thoughts for consideration this evening, and we can have a chant to close the session, and then the walking meditation after that. So let us chant the sharing of blessings, which we can ignite the lights, if someone would be so kind. Page 33, Verses of Sharing and Aspiration. Now let us chant the verses of sharing and aspiration through the goodness that arises from my practice. May my spiritual teachers and guides of great virtue, my mother, my father, and my relatives, the sun and the moon, and all virtuous leaders of the world, may the highest gods and evil forces, celestial beings, guardian spirits of the earth, and the Lord of death, may those who are friendly, indifferent, or hostile, may all beings receive the blessings of my life. May they soon attain the threefold bliss and realize the deathless. Through the goodness that arises from my practice and through this act of sharing, may all desires and attachments quickly cease, and all harmful states of mind, until I realize Nibbana in every kind of birth. May I have an upright mind with mindfulness and wisdom, austerity and vigor. May the forces of delusion not take hold, nor weaken my resolve. The Buddha is my excellent refuge. Unsurpassed is the protection of the Dhamma. The solitary Buddha is my noble lord. The Sangha is my supreme support. Through the supreme power of all these, may darkness and delusion be dispelled.
Arahaṃ sammāsambuddho bhagavā. The Lord, the perfectly enlightened and blessed one, buddhaṃ bhagavantaṃ abhivādhemi. I render homage to the Buddha, the blessed one. Sakato Bhagavata Dhammo. The teaching so completely explained by him. Dhammam namassami. I bow to the Dhamma. Supatipanno Bhagavato Savaka Sangho. The Blessed One's disciples who have practiced well, Sanghang Namami, I bow to the Sangha.